Welcome to another zany episode of Mr. Sledge's Neighborhood, where the subject matter is easy and the host is hard. Wait, strike that, reverse it. On this week's episode, I get way too detailed about fictitious space future planes. I verify that adding Bluetooth and LEDs to things make them better. I rate Dick Grayson's ass in the latest DC animated film. And I let the Wheel of Destiny take me for a spin in the grim dark. Strap in, strap up, and strap on, because in the future, there's only war. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Zestfully clean.
Zest announces a whole new kind of clean.
Are you tired of 21st century hygiene standards and wish you could go back to a less civilized time?
Zestfully clean.
You're not fully clean unless you're zestfully clean.
Introducing new improved Zest deodorant bar.
Get rid of that tiresome clean smell when you wash your various dingly bits with our patented odorization technology.
Look at me. Do I look clean to you?
No, you don't look clean to me.
Surprise, I'm not fully clean unless I'm zestfully clean.
Really? Because you look like you just got drenched in Andre the Giant's taint sweat.
This is what happens with soap. Soap leaves a sticky film on you that won't rinse away.
Phrasing?
But new Zest leaves no sticky film. It rinses you fully clean.
A whole new kind of clean.
Zest fully clean. Zest fully clean.
You're not fully clean unless you're zest fully clean.
This product will not actually make you clean and is no way related to a bath product. Oversized branded towel not available for purchase. And now, the news. And it doesn't matter how much light and sound these Lego blocks emit, I will still step on them. News. When you are young, you never had the money to do things you wanted. When you're older, you never have the time. But sometimes there's a perfect storm of modeling enthusiast and childhood imagination that results in a product we didn't know we needed. Introducing the PFX blocks. Lego blocks that can emit light, sound, and motion. The PFX brick was designed and developed by longtime LEGO fans Jason Ellman and Michael Gale in order to add extra magic to their own LEGO creations. Using their engineering skills and experience, the PFX bricks has evolved from a concept to a mature pre-production prototype. Jason and Michael launched the Kickstarter campaign to develop these beauties, and holy hell can they do a lot. They can store up to 20 minutes of uncompressed audio. The LEDs can be programmed into hundreds of patterns and frequencies. The motors can power existing LEGO parts and can adjust the rate at which those objects move, and even what sounds it should make at what speed. Seriously, check out their Kickstarter video and you will be blown away. The bricks use both infrared and Bluetooth. Yes, it has its own phone app and will have ongoing updates. This shit is state-of-the-art, and it's for children's toys, and for people like us. If it gets fully funded, hopefully you will see these little bricks out before the holiday season. As of recording this, there are 14 days left to go at the Kickstarter, and they still have about $60,000 to raise. So if you love LEGO, love electronics, and have a bunch of money to spare, help these guys out and get something amazing in return.
Fiery sky shall light the way. Shall spill over the wandering world. The spear of Cain shall call the wayfarers, and the storm prince shall unite them.
And maybe now I can get my seams to line up. News. The new Thunderhawk gunship has been spotted flying around the Games Workshop Nottingham offices and has caused quite a stir on the tabletop gaming community. Forge World states, the new resin Thunderhawk keeps the iconic and uncompromising outline of the Thunderhawk we all know and love, but also takes in a few design cues from other recent kits, like the Stormbird and Heresy-era Space Marine Legion tanks, end quote. This one appears to have been CAD-created, instead of the hand-modeled design created, and it has more symmetry, because, dear God, sometimes I could never get these things to line up. I just used lots of hot water, bending resin, maybe heat gun, maybe even a hairdryer to try to get these things to fit right. The overall dimensions are about the same, if not a little bit smaller, but there are changes all over the place, and they did a great job of bringing so much over the little details, like vents, you know, directly behind the cockpit, and there's even a whole bunch of bigger alterations. They redesigned the main fuselage with a sloping upper left and right sides, as opposed to, like, the flying bread box that we all, you know, became familiar with. There is a better plastic canopy that goes over the thing. It's a lot longer. Larger windows. And it apparently will actually fit better, which is also a good thing. There are larger, more prominent wing root air intakes. There's a dorsal turbo laser and a slightly thinner with a less blocky rear weapon housing. Air brakes and thrust reversers on the rear fuselage are now more detailed and open in the opposite direction. Horizontal stabilizer on the model is gone. Apparently, this model of the Thunderhawk maneuvers more on the brute thrust and less on airfoils. There's a large hinge mechanism that opens and lowers the forward ramp as well. So if you want to get super detailed and stuff like that, you can make that front ramp go open and close a whole lot easier than in previous models. The previous Thunderhawk has been in service for a while. It was one of Forge World's first big kits back in 2004. And has been with us for 13 years, and dear God, it shows. Anyone who's built one of these knows that these early resin monsters are all alike. While the overall detail was good, fit and finish was very hit or miss. The old kits had some extremely thick resin parts, which are prone to warping, leaving the kit with large gaps that require major sanding, nasty with resin, or large amounts of filling, which, my goodness, always keeps some green stuff on hand. Getting exact parallel clean lines was often difficult with some of these parts, and it almost never lined up. Oh, well, that's it for the era of the first Thunderhawk. It was a technical achievement at the time, and still should give you some, you know, respect when you put it on the table, because, hell, that also cost a lot. But the new one looks miles ahead, is much more detailed, and is fit to finish. I can tell you that trying to pull off the new cockpit clear plastic bit and its large size and complex edge would probably not have been possible in 2004. But then again, all good things do come to an end, and new things will come and take their place. New, better things. Because that's what happens in the modeling community. Almost always. Almost.
Guess we know who's taking out the garbage at the new place.
That was not a confidence booster.
You did very well. You lasted far longer this time. I meant in training, of course. He's very proficient when we have...
Corey!
In this week's review, I look at the latest release from DC Animation, Teen Titans, The Judas Contract. If you've read anything that I've written about DC Animation films, you know that I love the studio and pretty much everything they put out. They've never really made a bad film, even if the adaptation of The Killing Joke left much to be desired. Their work on the New 52 New Universe has done some amazing things. The second Teen Titans movie does not disappoint. The Judas Contract gives us a whole lot more than just another Teen Titans-themed story. We see at the beginning of the film the original Teen Titans with Dick Grayson, as Robin, driving his original team around in a buggy. Kid Flash, Bumblebee, Speedy, and Beast Boy help Robin save a hunted Tamaranian named Coriander, or as she would become known as, Starfire. 5 years later, Grayson is all grown up as Nightwing. Starfire is leading the Titans, Damian is the new Robin, Jaime is the new Blue Beetle, Garfield is still the lovable BB, Raven has dealt with her daddy issues, and the newest member, Tara, is having a hard time fitting in. Now, if you know anything about Titans history, then you know the story, just by me mentioning Tara. And if you don't understand that, then you probably don't understand the subtitle, The Judas Contract. The Titans have been investigating a religious criminal organization known as The Hive, which is led by a charismatic-slash-homicidal leader, Brother Blood. With a penchant for bathing in the blood of his enemies, Brother Blood has lived for almost a millennium. But what is immortality if you don't have the power to subjugate the masses? Good thing technology has arrived enough to allow the transference of superpowers to a single entity. And guess who he has in mind? No, not Superman. No, not Wonder Woman. No, not Green Lantern. Stop guessing. Anywho, Brother Blood has to hire somebody to take care of the Titans. And wouldn't you know who is available for hire? No, not Deadshot. I told you to stop guessing. Deathstroke. Deathstroke is tasked with taking down the Titans. Deathstroke has an ace in the hole, or more precisely, a traitor on the team with Tara. See, Deathstroke is a master at manipulating and has been training Tara in the ways of Merkcraft by taking advantage of her own daddy issues, which she has in spades. Seriously, we're talking dad crush levels wrong, which Deathstroke plays up. Honestly, I think he likes it. Though it seems he wants to be Robin's daddy more than he wants to be Tara's. Don't believe me? Listen.
Beast Boy is sending you pictures of Tara's party. Shame you're missing it.
You should go. Playing with teenagers is about your speed.
I'm not gonna let you bait me, kid. Oh, what the hell?
Big man.
It's a shame I don't have more time to break you down. Inside a month, I'd have you braying me my pipe and calling me Papa.
Slade, get your head out of your ass. Are you seeing this?
So, Tara and Deathstroke take down each Titan in turn, and all that is left is Nightwing. Grace intends to get under the skin, though, and Deathstroke really hates everybody in the Bat family, so instead of taking him captive, he shoots Dick. Right in the chest. But Robins have a hard time dying, or at least staying dead. And Grayson, of course, has to come to the rescue as he fits his ass into another pair of spandex. What follows is an amazing animated fight scene. Of course, the good guys win, because duh, but the animation kicks it up a notch here at the end. It is amazing. What is also amazing is the denouement. The film doesn't really end after the bad guys losing to the good guys. There is this amazing interview scene with Beast Boy and Kevin Smith. Yes, the Kevin Smith. It's kind of heartfelt. It is a bit cheesy. Well, it's honestly, it's everything that Kevin Smith is at times. But it is really, really good. And it was kind of heartfelt. And I kind of loved it. Now, this is a Teen Titans movie. The dialogue is going to be cheesy and a bit angsty. If you're watching it with a non-comic fan, they will probably comment on this. My wife literally said, barf, when Beast Boy and Tara kissed. It is that bad. Well, maybe. But the previous Teen Titans movie had a Sailor Moon-esque montage scene, so don't judge it too harshly. I rate this movie an easy 8.5 out of 10 awkward sexual references. I can't wait for the next movie. Who knows? Maybe Starfire will bang trucker hat-wearing Arsenal. We can only hope.
Do you ever get out of that uniform?
Only when I bathe.
Might be time.
I'm good.
It's that time for the part of the show where I throw caution into the wind and spin the wheel of insanity. Wheel of insanity, turn, turn, yada, yada, yada. Give me something good this time. Huh. It simply says, pay homage to the Golden Throne. For those who are inducted, that is a reference to the God Emperor of Mankind from the Warhammer universe. For those uninitiated, consider the following a primer. The Emperor of Mankind is the sovereign of the Imperium of Man, and father, guardian, and god of the human race. He has sat immobile on the Golden Throne of Terra for 10,000 years. Although a once-living man, his shattered body can no longer support life, and there remains intact only by a combination of ancient technology and the sheer force of his will. Itself, which is sustained by the soul sacrifice of countless millions of Psykers. The Emperor's role as guardian of mankind seems to have been predestined for him. Without the Emperor, there would be no Imperium, little space travel, and no protection from a multitude of threats facing mankind. The Emperor knows that to protect his race, he must survive as long as necessary for the emerging race of psychic humans to evolve sufficiently. In the millennium since his ascension to the Golden Throne, the Emperor has become a god to his people, the worship of him uniting humanity throughout the Imperium, superstition and dogma replacing his doctrine of imperial truth, while the demon kind refer to him as the Anathema. Little is known about the majority of the Emperor's life, of who he was and what he did before he emerged as the great Emperor of Mankind. Only the Emperor himself remembers. A few pieces of information have come to light from various different sources and present some small parts of coherent whole. However, their reliability is often disputed, especially as the Emperor's tale changes somewhat with each retelling. It is said that the Emperor's birth, while a natural process, was actually the result of a scheme created by the wisest and most powerful of human beings at the time, the Conclave of Shamans. These men, termed shamans by their society, were powerful psychers with great experience in the warp. Finding their souls and those of humanity endangered by the growing perils of warp gods, these psychers decided to pool their powers into one human, a being they called the New Man. Already having gained the power to reincarnate themselves, upon death the shaman souls would transfer to the warp, accumulating power enough to reincarnate as human. The shamans entered a suicide pact. Thousands of them poison themselves and spread their souls to the warp at the same time. Presumably, pooling their soul energy and using the reincarnation ability, they brought about the birth of their new man, the Emperor, 1 year later. The same source states that the Emperor was born to mortal parents on Terra in the 8th millennium BCE. Manifesting his power as a youth, one account of the Emperor's origin goes as far as he had immortal brothers and sisters and details the time and location of his birthplace, 8,000 years before the first millennium, in a primitive village along the banks of the Sakaryana River. While the young adolescent, the Emperor's father was murdered by his uncle. While preparing his father's body for primitive funeral ritual, he received a vision of his murder. Later, the boy who would become the Emperor calmly approached his uncle and stopped his heart with his psychic abilities, displaying neither sorrow nor malice. According to the Emperor himself, this was the moment he realized that humanity needed law, order, and guidance of a ruler. Shortly after, he left his village for the first city of humanity, likely a city in ancient Sumeria. The immortal being who had become known as the Emperor proceeded to haunt the history of humanity as a ghost, watching, waiting, and occasionally influencing. Living secretly amongst mankind, he developed his abilities until the psychic might allowed him to gain knowledge of not only his own world, but of the dangers beyond it. Aware of the vast predations awaiting humanity, the being that would become known as the Emperor resolved to guide and protect humanity. Eventually, over 10,000 years before his current circumstances, he took the struggle to open primarily because of the increasing number of psychers, whose very existence endangered their species. During the Dark Age of Technology, the man who would become the Emperor traveled to the planet Moloch, where there was a gateway to the Realm of Chaos. The Emperor entered the gateway and made a bargain with the dark gods of the warp, and emerged wielding a measure of their power, including the ability to create the Primarchs. However, for some reason, the Emperor did not keep his end of the bargain to spread chaos to humanity, and he became an anathema to the ruinous powers. The Emperor was able to clone the energy he was imbued with, giving them to his Primarchs. At some point in Earth's history, the Emperor discovered an ancient device beneath the ruins of Asia's deserts and became determined to completely cut off humanity from the malignant influences of the warp. This first step in his grand project was to substitute warp travel with the webway. And the final phase would see the Emperor shepherd humanity's evolution into a truly psychic race independent of the chaos, ascending to a level not even the Eldar were able to get to. The grand ambition was the guide of all the Emperor's undertakings and would be the culmination of his planning. After the Emperor united all of humanity on the planet Terra, the Emperor prepared extensively for a great crusade. He created his special astropath core to link the eventual domain together, and caused the creation of the Astronomicon, a supremely powerful signal device powered by the Emperor's own psychic mic that would allow simplified and safer travel through the warp. Chief among these designs, however, was the creation of superhuman warriors, the logical extension of gene troopers already under his command. He was first to undertake the Primarch Project, the creation of 20 infants from his own genetic code, designed to mature into powerful generals for his armies. However, this plan went awry with the intervention of the Chaos Powers. While accounts vary as to exactly what happened, the end of the tale was always the same. The Primarchs were cast into the warp and thought lost. In the aftermath of these events, the Emperor evolved a new plan. Using genetic material which had been derived from the Primarchs, he created caste warriors, which would possess some of the qualities of the Primarchs. These successors to the genetically altered warriors of the Unification Era were the Legionaries Astartes, or Space Marines, of the First Founding. After purging the Thunder Warriors and replacing them with these more efficient warriors, the Emperor led the Space Marines into a reconquest of the Sol System. He drove Xenos enslavers from the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, and most importantly, achieved peace and eventual integration with the Mechanicum of Mars. This alliance provided the Emperor with much of the means and material to extend his crusade to the stars. With the final abatement of the warp storms began the Great Crusade. The Emperor's forces rediscovered human worlds, cast out alien oppressors, and claimed new territory aplenty. Perhaps most importantly, the Emperor, leading the crusade, rediscovered his lost sons, the Primarchs. Scattered throughout space, the infants were found, one by one, over a period of many decades. They reunited with their father and their kin. All were placed in command of the Astartes Legion, created from their respective gene seed, and played their part in forging their father's Imperium. The first amongst the Primarchs was Horus Lupercal, first discovered and first honored. Some 200 years into the Great Crusade, the Emperor decided to return to Terra and place Horus in charge of the military advancement of the Imperium in his stead. granting him the title of War Master. After the Olinor Crusade, the Emperor declared that the time had come for his sons to show him what great leaders they were. Turning his back on direct military interventions, the Emperor then created the Council of Terra, the Imperial Tithe, and expanded the civil governing bodies of the Imperium before retiring to seclusion beneath the Imperial Palace to begin work on his greatest ambition, the Webway Project. At some point, the Emperor left the palace to decree the Edict of Nicaea, forbidden the use of librarians within the Astartes legions. This turn of events did not please all of the Emperor's subjects, including several of his sons. In the final stages of the Great Crusade, the Emperor's most trusted son Horus succumbed to the Chaos Temptation. Horus was told that the reason the Emperor had left the Great Crusade was so that he could attempt to reach godhood, abandon all of his sons, and betray the one of the central tenets of the Great Crusade to enlighten humanity and free it from the bonds of the false gods. Horus saw it as his duty to save the Imperium, and turned on his father. Having corrupted fully half of the Space Marine Legions, Horus led them against the Emperor and plunged the fledgling Galactic Empire into a colossal civil war. This became the most terrible conflict in human history, and billions perished as the traitor legions tore apart the empire they had helped forge. The Emperor's son Magnus attempted to warn his father of the coming slaughter, but his telepathic message breached the Emperor's psychic wardens of the Imperial Palace and caused grievous malfunction to the Golden Throne. Distraught, the Emperor ignored Magnus's warning and banished his son from his sight. The Emperor then dispatched the Space Wolves under Leman Russ to bring back Magnus before him in chains. However, the now corrupted Horus intercepted the Emperor's orders and changed it, instead ordering the Thousand Sons destroyed. For the rest of the heresy, the Emperor was forced to deal with the Golden Throne's malfunction, which created the warp breach in the depths of the Imperial Palace. As demons flooded through the breach, the Custodian Guard and the Sisters of Silence held them at bay, while the Emperor punishingly exerted himself on the Golden Throne to prevent all of Terra itself from being swallowed. With his attentions turned to this crisis, the Emperor left management of Horus's rebellion to Malkador the Sigilite and Rogel Dorn, Primarch of the Imperial Fist. During this sad state of affairs, the Emperor engaged in telepathic communication with the lowly astropath Kai Zulane, who had been given a vision of the heresy's conclusion. During their psychic communiques, the Emperor revealed he not only knew of his ultimate fate, but also accepted it. Later, Korax, distraught over the disaster of Istan V, arrived at the Emperor's palace and demanded audience with the Emperor. Diverting some of his attention to the strenuous task of maintaining the Golden Throne, the Emperor psychically imbued part of the secrets of creating Astartes in his son's mind. Thus, Korax was able to rebuild the Raven Guard. After 5 years of maintaining the stability of Magnus's webway breach in the Golden Throne, the Emperor began to exhibit physical fatigue. He finally began to show signs of exhaustion, and his nose would bleed. Even the telepathic visions he sent to the Custodian Tribune, Ra Ediamon, after seeing the birth of his powerful demon, Drakion, in the warp, the Emperor knew that the War of the Webway had reached its climax, and the fate of mankind would soon be decided. The last act of Horus' rebellion was played out above Terra as the Emperor led a desperate assault against the Horus' flagship after the treacherous War Master deliberately lowered the void shields as an invitation for a final duel. Though the Emperor was a being of unfathomable psychic and physical might, Horus had become mighty indeed, bloated with the powers of the four Chaos Gods and gaining the Emperor's own powers on Molech. After a tragic battle, and though heartbroken at the loss of his favored son, the Emperor finally slew Horus, though the struggle left him close to death. At this state, he was found by Rogel Dorn. The dying Emperor dictated the plans for an arcane life support machine that would sustain his remaining cells for over 10,000 years, and he was subsequently interred in this altered version of the Golden Throne. Enthroned within the life-sustaining Golden Throne, the Emperor's will was transcended through his maimed body. The Emperor is now divorced from the day-to-day running of the Imperium. This is left to the Adeptus Terra, who govern in his name. If you can't tell from this little narrative, the lore of the 40K universe is rich and long. There are currently 67 novels, dozens of audio dramas, and novellas based on the Horus Heresy alone, which is technically Warhammer 30K. Some of the best writers in the business have left their mark on this universe, including authors like Aaron Dembski Bowden, Graham McNeil, and Dan Abnett. If this at all interests you, check out theblacklibrary.com for a full accounting. that's all I have time for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you like what you heard. If you did, head over to our Patreon page and pledge your money to our efforts. You can receive episodes early, get bonus content, and even get some personal messages from your favorite nerds. I'm Kevin saying, if you can't be big, at least you can be cute.